Ready? Yep. Well, welcome back, Team Grace. So we are in our second session now on our formation day here on the Second Vatican Council. We, of course, will pick up our conversation from our first session. You'll recall from our first session, very importantly, we stressed what the vision of Pope John the 23rd was for the Ecumenical Council, for Vatican II. And we especially relied on that opening homily in which he basically charted out the path for the Second Vatican Council. So now we're back. And what I'd like to do is maybe just give some facts real quick in terms of what Vatican II consisted of. And then I want to go back and talk more about the U.S. perspective during the time of the Second Vatican Council. So I want to kind of address that, what was happening not simply in terms of the Universal Church, but specifically what was happening in the United States, like what were the context in which we received the messages, the vision, the teaching of the Second Vatican Council. So first, just as a reminder, 1959, a good Pope John announces his intention to convene a council. The first session of the Second Vatican Council is actually not held until 1962. Now, it takes those 3 years to prepare, because remember, this was a surprise. Pope John had only been Pope about 3 months when he announces Vatican II. So there's a lot of fast-pedaling, trying to prepare things. And truth be told, we can look historically, there were some cardinals in service to the Pope who were purposely trying to slow things down, hoping that Pope John would die and that this idea of a council would die with him. So there was real work being done, preparation and so on, but there was also some very concerted efforts to slow it in order to kill it, the idea of this council, right? So, because a lot of people just didn't understand, like, no, councils were called when we have major issues or challenges or false teachings. That isn't the case right now. Why are we having this ecumenical council? So not only did they not accept the vision or understand it, but in some quarters, they sought to actively kill it, to, again, just wait it out, see, can this interim pope, as they saw him, will he make it? Can we kind of slow this down and see whether this council could just fade away? But, of course, good Pope John continued on, and in 1962, the first session of the Vatican Council, Second Vatican Council, was held. So it's a very important development. So we have that first session in 1962. Right after that first session, Pope John dies. And there has to be an election of a new pope. We're going to talk about that in our second session today. And the second pope decides, this is Paul VI, to continue the Second Vatican Council. The new pope could have chosen not to put it on hiatus or to end it. But he chose to continue the Second Vatican Council. And so there are three more sessions. So we have the first in 1962, the second in 1963, then 1964, and 1965. So there ends up being four sessions of the Second Vatican Council. It's concluded in 1965. From the four sessions of the Second Vatican Council, there are 16 documents that are issued. Four of them are constitutions. Three are apostolic constitutions. That is the highest authority of the church, an apostolic constitution. It's the highest teaching document in the church. And three are issued, apostolic constitutions. A fourth constitution is given, but they describe it as a pastoral constitution. Now, that was interesting because that term had never been used before, nor since. And there's huge debate in terms of what exactly is a pastoral constitution, right? So, okay, four constitutions, and they deal with the liturgy, the life of the church, divine revelation, and the church in the modern world. So four constitutions on those areas. Also, from the constitutions, we have three declarations. So these are less authorities, and the three declarations dealt with education, non-Christian religions, and religious freedom. So we have four constitutions, three declarations, and then nine decrees. And the nine decrees, those address very specific areas in the life of the church. The nine decrees dealt with the media, the Eastern Rites of the Church, ecumenism, the life and ministry of bishops, religious life, priestly training, the apostolate of the laity, the missionary activity of the church, and the priestly ministry. So in total, 16 documents, 4 constitutions, 3 declarations, 9 decrees. And by these 16 documents, almost every area of the church was being addressed and reviewed and given this spirit of aggiornamento. Where can these areas, in terms of how they're presented or how they're lived out or how they're exercised by the church, how can they experience an updating? How can we say, here is our contemporary world, now how can these areas be revised? Never touching nor changing, we cannot, the immutable, unchanging teachings of Christ in the church. But in terms of how things are processed or exercised or completed or done, right? How can that be fixed? And that's where the 16 documents of Vatican II come in. All right, so that's just a summary. 4 sessions, 16 documents, and so on. Let's now look at what was happening in the United States. In particular, some things that now we can take for granted and forget some monumental changes that were happening in the church in the United States during the 1960s and while this Second Vatican Council was happening. So first, let's go back and say and remind ourselves that the Catholic Church was never a welcomed entity in the United States. We were always viewed with suspicion because it was perceived, this loyalty to this foreign pope. Right. So Catholics were approached with suspicion. Can Catholics really be good Americans? The WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, predominant culture of the United States, did not readily welcome Catholics. And again, we were kind of seen as the outsiders, approached with suspicion. We were the ones who did the domestic work that no one else wanted to do. So we were the bricklayers, the housemaids. We were the ones who took care of the horses and the livestock. We were the domestics. Right. We were the workers. And something we should be very proud of as a Catholic community in the United States is whatever recognition or status that we have in American culture now, we as a people, we earned that. None of that was given to us. We had to work hard. In fact, we were not welcome in public schools. That's how the Catholic school system got started. We were not readily welcomed in hospitals, nor could we afford them, which is how the Catholic hospital system was started. So all of the institutions that we have now that we kind of just assume and take for granted that we have parallel organizations, public school, Catholic school, public hospitals or private hospitals, Catholic hospitals. We just take this for granted. We forget that the reason why we have these is not simply to do the work of the gospel, that's very important, but also is because we were not welcome in American culture. And again, we had to earn that. So that's very important for us to stress. So what changed that? Well, a lot of things. The virtue of Catholics, the hard work. Regrettably, there was some compromise that was a part of it. But the huge event in American history that changed the perception of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States was the election of John F. Kennedy as president. And not simply was it President Kennedy, but it was that entire Camelot movement, right? So it was this dashing young president who spoke so well and was such a visionary. It was his beautiful and attractive, appealing wife, you know, Jackie. It was this whole movement, the Camelot movement it's described, that very much changed the perception of the Catholic Church. So we went from being the outsider approached with suspicion to suddenly now this charming, intriguing institution of this young president and this young first lady. And suddenly everyone wanted to know about the Catholic Church. Everyone was interested in the aspects of the Catholic Church. So from 1959 until 1962, it's the first session of the council. The council's announced in 59. It's held the first session in 62. During that period, we, of course, have the campaign, the election, and then the early presidency of John F. Kennedy. And again, that does a lot. And a lot of times when we talk about Vatican II, especially in the United States, my perception is that we don't stress this aspect enough. Because what happens? Suddenly, again, the media is interested in the Catholic Church. The political world is interested in the Catholic Church. Hollywood is interested in the Catholic Church. Suddenly, we see this heightened interest in the Catholic Church. And at the same time, concurrently, there's this major event being prepared for, and then it opens in 1962, of this Second Vatican Council. The Church is going to undergo this updating, right? This aggiornamento. So suddenly now everyone is interested in the Catholic Church. But what else is happening in the United States? Well, multiple things. In fact, as I describe all these areas of social change, you might even be shocked. Say, wow, I knew about that. Like, the idea that these were all happening at the same time. So as I described the presidency of John F. Kennedy, following that, we, of course, have the civil rights movement that begins in the late 50s and really takes root in the early 60s and mid-60s. So we have now this whole reassessment of our social order, of the proper relationship between all the races within our country. So we have what eventually becomes the civil rights movement. We have the pre-sexual revolution, and then, of course, the full sexual revolution in the mid-1960s and late 1960s. But all that begins in the late 1950s, early 60s, and then it begins to really just take root, like to explode in terms of this, as it's now called the sexual revolution, right? All that's happening. So questions about the nuclear family, questions about marriage, question in terms of divorce, right? Things that had never been even spoken of publicly, now suddenly begin to be normalized and almost seen as types of liberation. So we see this very much in this pre-sexual revolution, and then in the full sexual revolution itself. And concurrent with that is the women's movement. Right? So we see this not simply civil rights movement, but this kind of women's movement that is connected to this, as well as the sexual revolution. And this, of course, we can see leads to immense social instability, social questioning, social change. And all this is happening, right, while Vatican II is being prepared for and opens. So you can imagine, to throw this universal church ecumenical council in the midst of this American scene, the council is immediately threatened, the vision, by being hijacked or taken over by ideologues who have their own agendas. Because if they're in the civil rights movement or the women's movement, or they're in the pre-sexual revolution, right, they have something else that they want to push, and they want legitimacy. They want an authority. They particularly want to make inroads into this Catholic Church that appears to be this monolithic entity that is the bastion against everything that they want to do, in particular the more negative and evil things, right? Dismantle the nuclear family, to normalize sexual expression even outside of marriage, and so on, right? So, and even in the good areas, such as the civil rights movement, we see efforts to turn the church into just one large social movement, as if the church was simply one huge nonprofit that was simply to work for this particular good work. And while the church should be committed to such good work, the church is far above such things, right? The church exists in order to praise God, to seek the salvation of all people. That's the principal work of the church. And of course, she engages in these other areas, but the identity of the church must be preserved. She's the bride of Christ. She's not a social worker, right? So you can see the immediate threat and a lot of the movements that want to take over this renewal effort of the Roman Catholic Church. Now, In the United States, now we're all Americans, so we live this, and sometimes we don't fully appreciate or realize that in the United States, because we only have two main political parties, our political situation tends to be extremely, severely binary. So you're either one or the other. And a lot of other developed countries, you could have as many as 3, 5, 7 political parties. So there's a lot more diversity in terms of expressions or variations of views on social issues. But in the United States, we are very binary. You're either one or the other. Either in reality, or we clump you that way. We make you, we name you in this way. So add to everything I've just said, all this social change, and then this very specific binary political view, approach to politics in the United States, and impose that on top of all that's happening. And you find very quickly that first, we want to impose upon something else a political perspective and a binary political perspective on this movement. And so suddenly we begin to see that words like conservative and liberal are being applied to the Council Fathers and to the movements within the Ecumenical Council, within Vatican II, to bring about reform. These are political terms. And they become very popular, especially in the American media. So the media now is very interested in this Catholic Church. There's massive social change, and they can kind of present these type of camps and battles that are happening between the liberals and the conservatives, and so, and it gets all played up. And it's particularly focused on a series, you can see it reflected because of this focus, in a series of articles that are written in the New Yorker magazine by a person who's identified as Xavier Wren. Now, I don't think that this series of columns, of articles, receives the attention that's due, because this person, it's a pen name, begins to present to the American public and the Catholic Church within America, within the United States, a very politicalized view of the Second Vatican Council. Because it's the New Yorker. That's what sells. That's what they want. They want the tension. They want the battles, right? One of the models of the media, it bleeds, it leads. So even when there is no tension or there is sincere disagreement, it's presented as tension and battles, and the two camps are going back and forth, and who's going to win, and what. And these series of articles do not help with the presentation of Vatican II in the United States. It politicalizes it, and it presents it in this binary view, and it uses political terms in order to express it. And those series of articles by Xavier Wren become very damaging to the real work of the ecumenical councils, an act of faith, a movement of the Holy Spirit, a movement within the body of bishops in order to discern what God is asking of the church. Just by way of compare and contrast, imagine if we were to go to the Acts of the Apostles, and as the apostles are trying to figure out, can the Gentiles be welcomed into the chosen people, into the church? And if they're welcomed, do they have to be circumcised? These are very important questions. Circumcision was the mark of the chosen people going all the way back to Abraham. And these are major questions that the apostles are trying to figure out, to discern. And there are differences of views. Imagine if we were to add to those discussions massive social change, a very aggressive media, a politicalized situation that's binary, and we were to describe in terms, political terms, conservative, liberal, the movement among the 12 apostles as they tried to figure this out. And imagine if that was the coverage of the Acts of the Apostles, right? It would be severely damaging, not simply to the work of the apostles, but to the body of disciples who are trying to understand what the apostles are doing. And that's exactly what happened in Vatican II. And the media, and oftentimes a progressive ideology, tend to find very interesting bedfellows, tend to become very interesting bedfellows. So we find the media heightening this political view of the council and very much favoring and pushing this type of progressive agenda. And there are a lot of American Catholics who are watching or reading the media and are believing and accepting what's being presented. Wow, we got the conservatives fighting the liberals, and the liberals are trying to overtake the council. We've got this and going on, and oh no, the liberals won on this side, but the conservatives won on that side, and all this stuff is going on, and all. And it becomes, again, just very hurtful to the proper understanding of the council as a movement of the Holy Spirit, as an action of faith, and the successors of the apostles trying to figure out how best to discern what God is asking and then to do it. So I hope that this media and ideologue perspective can help. Incidentally, it was later discovered that Xavier Wren, who wrote these series of articles, was actually the Redemptorist priest, Father Xavier Murphy. And regrettably, as we look at Father Murphy's life, we see a reflection of a priest who was not doctrinally orthodox or faithful to our tradition. And no surprise that he would write these series of articles that would misrepresent or exaggerate the council, would tell people that the council was doing this when in fact the council was not. So again, these progressive ideologies. And people would believe, oh, that's what we're doing. That's where the Catholic Church is going. That's where our church is going. And it was inaccurate or exaggerated. So rather than a hermeneutic is an interpretive tool, an interpretive key, rather than a hermeneutic and perspective of faith, a political hermeneutic was applied to the council's deliberations. This became the almost exclusive presentation of the council in the United States. The political change, the Kennedy family and Camelot, the media, these ideologues who were involved in various social efforts and movements, the political perspective becomes predominant of the Second Vatican Council in the United States. The predominant view. Now, the views of John the 23rd, this pope who convened the council, which we discussed in our first talk, that view and his vision was rarely given by local bishops in their home dioceses. So we can point to all these other areas, and we should. We can try to see their influence and how they molded and shaped the reception of Vatican II. But concurrently, we have to acknowledge that a lot of bishops who were involved in Vatican II came home and they really didn't do much to teach or present Vatican II. This is why you can speak to older Catholics and they said they just showed up one day and suddenly the Mass was different. They showed up one day and the priest began to tell them, well, yeah, you can start to hang out and talk to your Protestant neighbors now. And suddenly there's drastic and major changes, but no catechesis or little catechesis. So the bishops came home, and many of them, not all, there are a few shining exceptions, but many of them came home and really didn't catechize the people or their priests, and the priests, therefore, weren't able to catechize their parishes. And a lot of priests, their heads were spinning as much as the faithful. Like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? What's happening? And so in full honesty, as we assess the situation, we have to acknowledge that the catechetical movement to instruct and teach and to fully and within our tradition present Vatican II was not done well. Now, incidentally, I said there are a few exceptions. And one such exception on the international scene was the young bishop, Archbishop of Krakow, Poland, Karol Wojtyła, who was at the Vatican Council, the Second Vatican Council, who returned home and then convened a diocesan synod, the gathering of priests and lay leaders, in order to discuss what the work of Vatican II meant to his diocese. And then from there, he wrote a series of instructions that were eventually put into a book under the title Sources of Renewal. So there's one exception, a shining example of a bishop who was at Vatican II, came home, and then made sure that not simply that it was implemented, but that it was taught and explained within our tradition, not allowing the news media to become the catechist, but the church remaining the catechist and the church explaining to her own what's happening and why it's happening and why it is not happening. And so we see, of course, this young Polish bishop, archbishop, and it should not surprise us that the Holy Spirit would then raise him and he would, of course, become Pope St. John Paul II. So in general, we can say the catechesis was lacking. And regrettably, the news media became the de facto catechist. You can speak to older Catholics about this reality. They would go and suddenly major changes would happen at Mass or in the life of the parish, and nothing would be said. They would have to go home and either wait for the news or to read something in a periodical to find out why something was happening. And oftentimes the news or the periodical were not given the proper perspective. And those were the more energetic Catholics. Most Catholics, understandably, especially in light of how faith was understood and the role of the laity was understood, most Catholics just went along with it. That's what Father says, that's what Sister says. And regrettably, a lot of our religious and priests were involved in many of these social movements or had other agendas for the life of the church rather than her spiritual nature. And so we have these ideologues who usurp the work of the council, misrepresent or exaggerate it, not simply the media, not simply the progressive movement, but even our own priests and religious. And of course, many of them became so liberated and so obsessed with their movements that many of them end up leaving the church. Do you know, in the Catholic Church, we lost more priests after Vatican II than after the Protestant Reformation. So we see not simply a scandal in terms of all those who left the faith who should have been the most committed, but we also see a very clear indication of the lack of depth of faith among the clergy and those in the religious life. And many of them only left later after they had done some real damage to the faith of the people of God. Now, one area I want to talk about just briefly is the role of women religious in the United States. Now, anyone who knows me and has seen how I pastor and how I speak of our religious, they know how profoundly deferential I am to religious, especially women religious. I am so immensely grateful for that vocation in the life of the church. In fact, I remember years ago, I was at Memphis went to the Civil Rights Museum. It's the hotel where actually Dr. King was shot and killed. It has become a museum now to promote civil rights. And at the time, there was a passing presentation on the Catholic Church's involvement in the civil rights movement. So this particular exposition was there. It was a moving exposition. It happened to be there while I was there. And I was very moved. A lot of it, I did not know how much we did as Catholics in the civil rights movement. I remember one picture watching, seeing a woman religious in a full habit being sprayed with a fire hose by police officers. And the image of a woman religious in her habit being treated like that profoundly bothered me because of the immense love and respect I have for that vocation and how much I realize we need that vocation in the life of the church. So with that understanding of my respect, let me assess what happened to the religious life and specifically to women religious in the United States. The women religious have been our major evangelizers. In fact, the majority of American saints are women religious, no surprise. And oftentimes, let's use history to be our teacher. Oftentimes, they accomplish immense work for the church in spite of the established hierarchy. Many times, the hierarchy mistreated, neglected, or did not actively support the work of women religious. Just read how Mother Cabrini was treated when she arrived. And yet they accomplished a great work. Oftentimes, women religious were not treated well. They were not given appropriate support. You could have women religious who would run an entire school, serve, do everything they possibly could in the parish, and so oftentimes they would not even have enough food to feed themselves in the convent. They were not educated well. Whenever an older Catholic says, "Well, sister mistreated us," and she would yell and she would, use the rulers, the famous account, right, and so on. Oftentimes I ask, I said, "Well, how old do you think sister was?" And oftentimes people don't think like that. And they're like, huh. And they go back and they start to try to think. And they think, well, oftentimes sister was very young or very old. And the idea that as a church we would have women run entire schools, pack classrooms with multiple children, up to 40 plus children. Sister oftentimes was an older teen or young 20 who had no training in education. Oftentimes, sister didn't even have a high school diploma. So we threw them into responsibilities without making sure they were properly educated. They were not supported. Oftentimes, their own religious formation was lacking. One religious sister told me she was a Franciscan, and it wasn't until the reform of Vatican II that she was first given instruction on Franciscan spirituality. She had been a Franciscan sister, but had never received instruction on Franciscan spirituality. Now, I say all that because there is a real issue that needed to be addressed. But oftentimes what happens is when someone is in a situation where they are not being supported, then as soon as they have some type of liberation or power, if they don't temper that with virtue, then they can actually cause a further injustice. And regrettably, what happened in a lot of our religious orders were that the sisters who had been mistreated and not supported, when they received some aspect of freedom or some opportunities for education or to empower themselves or to support the convent by additional means, sometimes even independent of the church and the hierarchy, they went to the other extreme. And they began to contribute to the lack of justice that they had received, but now that they are imposing. And this is where we see oftentimes women religious who would abandon the habit, abandon their orarium, which is their set of prayers, abandon communal living, so no longer live as a community, as a group of religious sisters. They would diminish the role of authority within their convents. They would form separate entities, legal entities, independent of the bishop, so that he would have no legal recourse if they were to disobey him. And this is what we see constantly. And suddenly we see Jesus is just fading away. The church is fading away. And what becomes prominent are social issues. Now, these social issues are important and we should be committed to them, but suddenly the social issues became their religion. And many of these sisters, they either left or they completely changed their order into something that even a pew-sitting Catholic could look and say, I don't think that's Christian. That doesn't look very Christian. That doesn't look very Catholic. And this is how we can get to the state, to the point where we have professed women religious who will not support the unborn. Professed religious who want to be identified as lawyers or social workers before brides of Christ. I want, as a church, that we take accountability for the lack of support that was inflicted upon the sisters. It's important that we know that history. But concurrently, to see that their response, many times, not always, but many times, was to simply add to the further injustice and the lack of fidelity to the gospel. If a bishop does not support the religious women in his diocese, it's a lack of justice. He's not living up to his gospel mandate. But when the women religious begin to receive some type of freedom or education, and they use that in order to then not be instruments of the church's work, and oftentimes to be antithetical to the very work of the church, then simply what they're simply doing is adding further to the infidelity and the lack of justice. And so we see in particular a lot of women religious hijack Vatican II, misrepresent it, exaggerate some of its teachings, and sometimes just bold-faced lie in terms of what Vatican II was asking. I want to just conclude our second session with some clear catechesis. Some things that we need to have in our minds. Some catechesis that should have been received decades ago. And some places did. And there were some shining examples of good women religious. I know of one community that 3/4 of the community left. But the 1/4 of women religious who stayed continued to pray the Liturgy of the Hours, continued to wear their habit, continued to persevere, and that order is thriving today. They're running out of room because the young women want to join that order. Because those older sisters, they were faithful. They were faithful, and God was able to bless them. So there are some shining exceptions to what I'm describing. But let's give some catechesis that can help us. First, the purpose of an ecumenical council is to bring reform to the church. Oftentimes, it's to address a particular false teaching or a pernicious school of thought. And for good Pope John, that's how he saw the church. The Holy Spirit moved him to look upon the church and say, you know, yes, we have communism, but you know, that is not an immediate threat to the entire church. In certain areas, definitely a threat. But okay, we have some communism. We still have some enlightenment thinking. But he also looked and said, we have a lot of indifference, and we have a lot of people who are even doing the right things, but they don't even understand what they're doing. We've lost the spiritual life. We've lost the sense of discipleship. And so the purpose of the council is to bring reform. John the 23rd was called by the Holy Spirit to bring reform. This aggiornamento, to update the church in order that the church might live up to her vocation given by God to pursue holiness and to share the gospel. That is the main point I wish that every parish in the 1960s would have received that catechesis. Dear people, our Holy Father, Pope John, has convened this council in order to help us to become saints, to understand that we all have vocations as the baptized, that we are to grow in our relationship with Christ. We need to pray and read the Bible, receive the sacraments in an intentional way. We need to serve the poor. We need to develop our community life. And we have to go out and share the good news with all of our neighbors. And I regret that that didn't happen in a lot of parishes in the 1960s. I further regret that that's still not happening in a lot of our parishes today. In many times and in many places, we can say that still the mission and the legacy of the Second Vatican Council has not found root in many parishes. But that's the first point, the purpose of an ecumenical council. Secondly, the authority and the boundaries of a council. So the authority of a council completely relies on the authority of the Pope. The work of the apostles relied on Peter. The work of the bishops rely on the Pope. And there's an authority given to the ecumenical council, the highest of authorities, because when the bishops are united to the Pope, when the apostles are united to Peter, the full authority of the church is being exercised. But there are boundaries even to that authority. One cannot take the application of a teaching in one area and then, without any type of direction, apply it somewhere else. Well, because we do this here, that means we can do it over here. No, there are boundaries. When we begin to blur principles or teachings or practices or exceptions or dispensations, and we just start to apply them all over the place, we have exceeded the boundaries. So there's an authority and there are boundaries. And when a council is addressing a specific area, it should be taught. So one of the decrees was on the apostle of the laity. And that was never taught to the laity in many places. There's a whole teaching of an ecumenical council, a particular area with boundaries, on how the laity are to be involved in the work of the church, and it's not taught. Or worse, it's taught wrongly. If you want to be an empowered Catholic Christian, then you have to get involved. You have to be in the decision-making of the church, and you have to make sure that you are up there at the altar, and you have to make sure you don't... Wait a minute. That has its place, but that's not the main work of the laity. That's the main work of the priests. And the laity can participate in that, but if they participate in those areas, it should be something that's in addition to their main work. And what is the main work of the laity? To go and convert the world to Christ. To look at their profession and say, how can I bring Christ or Christian virtue into this area, this work that has been given to me by God? No matter what it is, in the business field, transportation, education, whatever it might be. In some areas, we could be more explicit with our faith. In others areas, we have to be more discreet. So it can be perhaps just our virtue. But that's the main work of the laity, but that wasn't taught. So there's an authority and there are boundaries to an ecumenical council. There are clear teachings and goals of a council. What was the goal of John, Pope John? To update the council, the life of the church, in order that the church might fulfill her vocation. It has to be understood that one council does not stand on its own. That every council, all 21 of them, must be placed within the full context of the sacred tradition. That means Vatican II relies on Vatican I. Vatican I relies on Fifth Lateran. Fifth Lateran relies on Vatican II. Vatican II relies on Lateran V and on Lateran III. And Nicaea will rely on the later ecumenical councils. It's a whole tradition. I can't say, no one should say, that one council defines everything in the life of the church. It must be placed back within the sacred tradition in order that the fullness of its teachings could be understood and tempered by the whole tradition. The Council of Nicaea, which was the first council outside of the early church, it's in the 4th century, that one council, it took at least 3 other councils to clarify what it taught. The councils rely on each other as well as the other areas of sacred tradition, the interpretive body that has existed alongside these councils. And so every council has to be placed within sacred tradition. I cannot say there's Jesus Christ, there's Pentecost, and then there's just Vatican II. That's bad theology, that's irresponsible, that is not true, that is not how a council works. We place every council within the full tradition because, again, it both tempers the work of that council as well as provides a holistic understanding of the work of that one council. And that is very important and has been almost completely ignored in the teachings when it comes to Vatican II. And the last thing I just want to say for our thoughts in this second session is that the capacity for error or correction of an ecumenical council. So when a council teaches on faith and morals, so Nicaea on the divinity of Christ, it is without error. Holy Spirit guides that. But when Nicaea begins to speak about the life of a priest or the rule that a monk should follow, there's room for change, updating. It can even be later discovered that a particular decree or canon in the life of the church was an error. Or once it was put in within the life of the church, it was discovered that didn't work. It didn't bring about the fruits that we were anticipating. So in terms of the practical areas of an ecumenical council, there can be error, misjudgment, a lack of prudence. And again, by placing an ecumenical council within the full tradition, the tradition tempers and matures all the work of the different councils. And so there might be some areas where even Vatican II would say, let's try this. And then as it lived out in the sacred tradition, it was discovered that doesn't work. Or we need to actually do it this way. Or we were right in what we were thinking, but the way that this was approached could be done differently. Now, some of that can apply to some of the teachings of Vatican II, the practical areas, but a lot of that applies later to the implementation of Vatican II. We're going to talk a little bit about that in our third session. But I wanted to clarify and give this basic catechesis, and this is the catechesis that should have been given in 1962 when the council first met, or even before then as the council was preparing. Because before 1962, the first session, you can look at the news reports, everyone was talking about Vatican II before it even started. And it's regrettable that a lot of catechesis wasn't given, especially of a council that was calling for the proper formation of the Christian faithful, of the Catholic faithful, in order to be strong disciples and strong witnesses to the gospel. But the fact that it wasn't done, that the catechesis was not done, indicates the problem that Pope John was trying to address. Our people don't know Jesus Christ. We have lost the spiritual life. We are not fulfilling the Great Commission to go and teach all nations. Okay, well, Team Grace, I've given you a lot, and there's actually more to say. I want, in our next session, to talk about Paul VI, and I want to give just a few examples of popular views of Vatican II, but then what Vatican II actually taught. And I'm going to mainly use the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, Sacrosanctum Concilium. It's probably the most contested constitution of Vatican II. I'm going to use that in order to show what Vatican II is actually asking for and unmask some of the misperceptions, sometimes willfully given, of what Vatican II supposedly said. So in our next session, Paul VI and some of those back and forth of Vatican II. You have about 10 minutes. I'm going to ask you to use these 10 minutes. I hope I've given you a few things to think about. And I look forward to our third session. I'll see you at 11 o'clock. God bless you.